I'm Marco Werman. One of the things I love about our show is all the music we feature from around the globe. We've heard from so many listeners that music on the world is something they look forward to. I know many of you become fans of the artists we introduce you to. I'm sure you're aware that we have a fundraiser going on right now. When you make a gift of $100 or pledge $10 a month, we'll send you a curated playlist highlighting some of our team's favorite tracks from the show. Whether you tune in for the music or the independent reporting on international issues, it's your support that keeps us going strong. Please give today to help power our nonprofit newsroom. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. Again, that's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. Now, on to the show. The Israeli military says its goals in Gaza are clear: dismantle Hamas and free the hostages. Our guest believes it'll happen fast.
This has to be done, and it will be done within the next few weeks.
The cost, though, to Palestinians has already been immense.
There's no future. All of my dreams are not there anymore.
Forever stateless, that is a big worry for people who fled Gaza. I'm Marco Werman. Also this hour, a court settlement could help families separated at the U.S. border access mental health care.
Being physically removed from a parent is going to create lifelong trauma.
And once a painkiller for dentists, it's also recreational.
They'll laugh. They'll definitely laugh.
But nitrous oxide for fun is now banned in the U.K. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being here. The Israeli military operation in Gaza City continues to tighten its grip. They're zeroing in on the now barely functioning Al-Shifa Hospital because, according to the Israel Defense Forces, a Hamas command center is located underneath it. Hamas denies that. Yesterday, the IDF released a video it claims was filmed under a different hospital, the Al-Rantisi Specialized Hospital for Children in northern Gaza.
We are now in the area of the basement of the hospital. These are explosives. These are vests with explosives.
In the video, flashlight beams rove across weapons on the floor. We could not independently verify that footage. What is clear, the human costs of the fighting are becoming more grim. So what does the end game of this military operation look like? I put that question to Meir Elron, a retired brigadier general with the IDF and senior researcher at the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University.
Well, first of all, it means that leadership has to be eliminated. The military leadership and their political leadership, all those who are presently in Gaza have to be eliminated. This is the number one issue, and this has to be done now.
But how do you do that? Does that involve destroying the tunnels?
We'll catch them.
Hand-to-hand battle in the streets.
It will mean that we'll have to take any measures to get to them and to kill them. The only way that they can save their lives, so to speak, is by surrendering. If they do that, we'll see what happens. Number two, all the weaponry and all the installations, the military installation, have to go. Number three, the tunnels have to go. Okay. And number four, all the other political installations and institutions of Hamas have to go. Those are the four important things that must be eliminated and will be eliminated. And I think that the IDF is making is a very, very good, very cautious and very careful kind of an operation in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. This has to be done, and it will be done within the next few weeks.
So you describe the operations as cautious. We have satellite imagery that shows a lot of bombardment in areas where civilians are located. Are the sort of precision strikes that discern between Hamas and civilians even possible?
Well, I think it is possible. Of course, Israel is making all the efforts that we can do in order to distinguish between the very large number of terrorists and terrorist installations. And we have made it very clear for the population to move forward to the southern part of the strip. This is what they are doing. And by doing that, they are saving their lives. And this is the idea, to save lives of Palestinians on one hand, the civilian Palestinians, and to capture and to kill those who are part of the Hamas machinery.
I mean, you're saying take care of the lives of civilians in Gaza, but hospitals are being attacked. We know there are patients inside. I mean, that's classifiable, as you know, as a war crime. Is the IDF comfortable with that?
Well, we are not. The IDF is not conducting any war crimes. We are working exactly within the boundaries of the international law dealing with these issues. Fortunately, many people who have been hospitalized in these institutions have been evacuated, and the rest of them are enabled, if they so wish, and if Hamas permits them and enables them to do that, which unfortunately is quite often not the case, then it is not really a hospital anymore. It is an installation, a military installation or a terrorist installation held by Hamas for their own protection, for their own needs. And this is something that has to be stopped.
But there are civilians involved in that. So how do you square that circle?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that we are enabling, and we are calling, as a matter of fact, the civilians, including the ones who are hospitalized, to get out of the area, which is a war zone, and to go down to the southern part of Gaza.
We're hearing that there's bombardments in southern Gaza. So how is that any safer?
Well, again, there are perimeters in the southern part of Gaza where the Palestinian civilians are being gathered, which are free of Israeli bombardments.
As far as Israel telling civilians in Gaza to move south, does that mean Hamas is only operating in northern Gaza, where the IDF is focused?
No, it also operates in the southern part of Gaza. It is launching rockets against Tel Aviv, something that happened just about an hour ago, and we had to go down to shelter, and they are launching them from the southern part of the Gaza Strip.
I mean, it seems at some point the IDF will be compelled to target the south of Gaza the way it's targeting the north now, if Hamas continues to shadow civilians.
Possibly.
And won't that just lead to more casualties?
This is unfortunately true, but you have to understand, if you want to dismantle Hamas, and this is a very, very legitimate objective on our part, they have to be consequently eliminated from the Middle East and from the world in general. And this takes power, this takes military action, and this takes also casualties. We have our own casualties, they have their own casualties, and they were not very keen on keeping our civilians safe. We are so much more keen on their civilians being safe, but this is the responsibility of the Israeli military to see to it that any civilian who can be saved will be saved.
But does this mean, once those battles start in the south, that all civilians are going to have to move back to the north? Is that what we're looking
at? No, I don't know exactly what the intention of the military is right now at this particular point.
How much is the Israeli military operation in Gaza and its continuation contingent on support from the White House?
Well, the support of the American people and the support of the White House is significantly important for us. And there are many reasons for that. First of all, it's the moral legitimacy that we have, because we have been attacked on October 7 in a very, very vicious manner. It is very important for the United States to be present militarily and to support Israel in this situation in the Middle East. I mean, irrespective of the American position, whether we as Israelis should look forward to a reconstruction and stability in the Gaza Strip and in the Middle East, my answer would be very positive.
Meir Elron is a retired brigadier general in the Israeli military and senior researcher for the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University. He joined us from Tel Aviv. Meir, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
A member of Israel's cabinet today endorsed the idea of sending Palestinians from Gaza to countries that will accept them. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich made the comments on his Facebook page. The post says the right humanitarian solution for the residents of Gaza is voluntary immigration to other countries with financial help from the international community. But Palestinians say this would effectively be ethnic cleansing. From Jerusalem, the world's Matthew Bell reports.
I reached Abdel Nasser Ajrami on a scratchy phone line in central Gaza. He says he left the Jabalia refugee camp with his family 2 weeks ago because Israel was bombing the neighborhood. Ajrami says he got a phone call from the Israelis right after their ground troops entered Gaza. He was told to leave his house, so that's what the family did in the middle of the night with 31 people in all. We didn't take anything with us, he says. For the next 4 days, he says they went from house to house in Gaza City, but nowhere felt safe. The UN-run schools and shelters were full, he says. Now the family is sleeping on mattresses in the street. Researchers at the City University of New York say that about a third of all buildings in the northern Gaza Strip are destroyed or damaged. At this point, Ajrami says he's looking for any place to go with the family where there is shelter. Itdidal Subhi Abu Kamar also fled from Gaza City. She's with her extended family near Rafah in the south. She worked for the economy ministry in Gaza. Now she's retired. Abu Kamar says what's needed now is a ceasefire. When I ask who she blames for the humanitarian crisis, she points out that Hamas does not represent all Palestinians. This is a diverse nation, she says. Hamas only represents a small sector of Palestinian society. How can we be held hostage by this one part of our community? For families in Gaza, it's not clear when they'll be able to find new homes. But they're not the only Palestinians with no place to go. This athletic facility in the West Bank city of Ramallah has been transformed into a shelter. There are hundreds of men from Gaza here, maybe a couple thousand. They are temporary laborers who were working in Israel with permission when Hamas unleashed its deadly cross-border attack on October 7th. After that, their work permits were canceled, meaning they were not allowed to stay in Israel, but they couldn't go home either. For weeks now, thousands of Gaza workers have been stuck here in the West Bank.
There's no permit to go to Gaza. There's no way to go to Gaza.
Ayad Hillis is a construction worker. He's sitting on a mattress next to the outdoor basketball court. He says he made good money working in Israel before the war. Since arriving here last month, he says he's been in touch with his wife and five kids. They got out of Gaza City, went south, and now they're staying at a UN school. But Hellas says his house was destroyed. He's hopeful about being able to get back to Gaza sooner than later. The road ahead, though, he says, is very bleak.
There's no future. All of my dreams are not there anymore. To die with your kids is better than grieving while being away.
Palestinians describe what's happening in the Gaza Strip as another catastrophe, or second Nakba. That's a reference to 1948, when the State of Israel was created, the first Arab-Israeli war began, and hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs were driven out of their homes or fled to neighboring countries. Now, many are afraid that history is repeating itself and that anyone who leaves Gaza might be forever stateless.
More than half of the Palestinian people are actually displaced. They are in diaspora today.
Dimitri Diliani is a reformist leader with Fatah, the Palestinian political party.
This is obviously and clearly is not an option for the Palestinian people. We will not repeat the catastrophe and displacement and diaspora again, ever again.
The Biden administration is urging the Israeli military to do more to prevent civilian deaths. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has also said that relocating people from Gaza abroad is not an option. But Diliani says that's not enough. Like many Palestinians, he's lost faith in the United States to be an honest broker in this conflict. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell in Jerusalem.
Our coverage of the war between Israel and Hamas continues online, where you can hear voices bringing you experiences from many perspectives. Listen to The World, listen at theworld.org, and in our podcast feed. Later this hour, we'll hear how the war between Israel and Hamas is being seen in Northern Ireland. A decades-long peace process there has eased some past divisions, but sectarian divides still dictate how Northern Irish see the conflict in the Middle East. You're listening to The World.
Want to dive into how technology and Black spirituality intersect? Or confront the challenges new tech is creating? Maybe even catch a vision of hope for the future?
Check out More Repair, a Black exploration of tech. A podcast about the innovations that make our world and break our societies.
And how we can all heal just a bit. Available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Sudan's Darfur region continues to witness waves of mass violence. Earlier this month, UN monitors say Sudan's rapid support forces killed some 800 people in a multi-day attack. That marks the single deadliest event since the country's civil war started in April. The paramilitary group, the RSF, is battling Sudan's national military for control of the region. The UN is warning that the escalating bloodshed could lead to another genocide. For more on that, we're turning to Cameron Hudson. He's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. He joins us from Washington. Cameron, the UN is warning of genocide now. What is your reaction as you see another ethnic cleansing campaign unfold in Darfur again, years later?
Well, I think we have to go back to the root causes and understand that we never fully addressed the root causes. We might have ended the fighting in Darfur 15 years ago by never seeking accountability for the people who carried out these crimes, namely the Rapid Support Forces. Back then, they were labeled the Janjaweed, but essentially the same organization. Because we never really dealt with the past, we're faced with the situation again where all of the same warring parties are committing many of the same crimes that we saw 15 years ago.
What more can you tell us, Cameron, about the kind of violence the RSF has exacted this month alone in Darfur?
Well, I think the first thing we have to say is that they have taken over most of the Darfur region. And so under their control, they have essentially been ethnically cleansing the region that they control of non-Arab tribes. So these are the Masalit, some Fur communities, much like we saw in the genocide that happened 15 years ago. So you're seeing, I think, the worst kinds of crimes that we have seen from the past. We have seen destruction of villages. We have seen just in the last few days, people being buried alive, entire families being gunned down. And of course, as a result of that, you're seeing massive refugee outflows into neighboring countries.
Genocide, of course, is a strong term with a precise UN definition, crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. Do you believe that what's happening in Darfur conforms with that definition?
The genocide label, I think, has lost a lot of its moral high ground in the last few decades when we haven't responded robustly enough when the crime has been committed. And so whether it's genocide or not, I don't think it necessarily meets the definition of genocide right now under the UN Charter. But that shouldn't, you know, dissuade us from taking, you know, very serious action to stop the violence that's going on there right now.
Is there anything the international community can do amid the fighting in Sudan to protect people in Darfur?
Well, I have to say that the conversation at an international level about protecting civilians in Darfur is completely absent. You know, the conversations that we're having in Gaza about humanitarian pauses, humanitarian corridors, these kinds of things, there's absolutely no discussion of that going on in Darfur. And in many ways, the playbook was written in Darfur 15 or 20 years ago for how we can continue to provide humanitarian assistance in environments that are experiencing this level of warfare. So I think that there is a hope, I think it's a misplaced hope, but a hope nonetheless, that some kind of political agreement, some elite political deal between the army and the RSF in Jeddah will, you know, take care of the problems in Darfur, that if we can get a peace agreement that we can get the parties to agree to, then the kind of the problems in Darfur will fade away. But we know from past experience that that's not going to be the case. That's not going to happen. The parties, first of all, don't appear to be interested in any kind of pause whatsoever. The Rapid Support Forces have no concern about the civilian casualties that are going on right now. And so I think it's very unlikely that even an elite political agreement struck in Saudi Arabia is going to bring any kind of relief to the people of Darfur.
Cameron Hudson is a senior associate in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joined us from Washington. Cameron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Around the world, doctors and dentists use nitrous oxide as a painkiller. It's also found as a preservative and propellant in cans of whipped cream. People also use it recreationally to get high. In the UK, the government just made that illegal, which not everyone thinks is the best approach. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
You may know nitrous oxide by a different name, maybe whippets or laughing gas. When it's used recreationally, most people fill a balloon with the gas and then inhale that gas from the balloon.
And then that brings on that short-acting high. They'll dance, they'll chat with their friends, they'll laugh, they'll definitely laugh.
Neve Eastwood is the executive director of Release, a London-based nonprofit which advocates for drug policy reform. She says the high only lasts for about a minute, and people may use another balloon in the same sitting. In the UK, Eastwood says nitrous oxide has been easy to buy in small canisters, which fill about two small balloons.
But what we then saw was complaints to MPs from constituents about these little small canisters being left in the road.
People use them, then toss them. That is what initially caught the politicians' attention, and they made plans to combat the drug. Here's UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak earlier this year.
So what we're going to do is ban nitrous oxide, because I think all of us for far too long have had to walk through places with the canisters and all the rest of it, and that's not acceptable.
Michael Gove doubled down on that reasoning in an interview with The Guardian. He heads up the UK's Housing and Communities Department.
We're doing it because if you walk through any urban park, you will see these little silver canisters, which are the evidence of people regarding public spaces as arenas for drug taking. That is unacceptable.
The UK is just the second country to ban recreational use of nitrous oxide after the Netherlands made a similar move earlier this year. It's also illegal across a number of states in the US. In a recent review, the UK government's own advisory council on the misuse of drugs stops short of recommending a ban on nitrous oxide. They say repeated nitrous oxide use can lead to serious neurological consequences, but there's no data on how many people that's currently impacting. Overall, the council says the health-related harms of the gas aren't enough to merit control.
It's so lacking in harms that most assessments of comparative drug harms don't even bother to include it.
David Nutt from Imperial College London studies the effects of drugs on the mind. UK government data shows 56 death certificates in England and Wales mention nitrous oxide from 2001 to 2020. But that includes deaths in medical settings too. So not all 56 cases were due to recreational misuse. Nutt is not part of the government's advisory council, but he agrees with their position that nitrous oxide shouldn't be criminalized and worries what consequences the ban will have.
What happened when they banned smoking of opium? People started injecting morphine. Was that good? Was that better?
Neve Eastwood from the nonprofit says she's also concerned about people turning to illicit underground markets to buy the gas.
And then what we've got is no regulation around what's actually within a canister. So that's going to be potentially resulting in more harmful substances.
The government's advisory council also notes that the ban could discourage users from seeking medical help. The UK's Home Office did not immediately reply to a request for comment in response to these criticisms. The ban went into effect this month, and people found in possession of the drug for recreational purposes could face up to 2 years in prison. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Esther.
And this is Second Sunday, a podcast about Black queer folk finding, keeping, and sometimes losing faith.
This season's full of candid conversations. We're talking to theologians, artists, activists, and community members living at the intersections of faith, spirituality, and identity.
The saints ain't ready for this.
But we're still going to talk about it.
Second Sunday. Find it wherever you get podcasts.
Second Sunday is a Cube original podcast and is part of the PRX Big Questions project.
With China's increasing aggression toward Taiwan, indigenous communities in Taiwan's mountains are taking the country's defense into their own hands.
The Taiwanese aborigine are actually the last samurais, the last warrior.
Also ahead, what the conflict between Israel and Hamas means in Northern Ireland, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The past month has seen demonstrations across the globe, support for Israel post-October 7th, as well as protesters expressing solidarity with Palestinians now under attack. We've seen such rallies in Ireland, one of the most pro-Palestinian countries in Europe. Its Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has repeatedly called for a humanitarian ceasefire. But in Northern Ireland, the picture is more complicated. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
A 45-foot-high wall runs the length of the Folds Road in Belfast. This is a mainly Catholic neighbourhood, and the wall is covered in political murals, many commemorating those who died fighting against years of British rule. A couple of weeks ago, though, a new mural was unveiled.
As we stand here now in West Belfast, we send a message to our Palestinian brothers and sisters in Gaza City and throughout the occupied territories. You have not been forgotten.
That's Pat Sheehan, a lawmaker for the Republican Party Sinn Féin. The mural he unveils shows two children huddled together in rubble, one draped in the Palestinian flag. It's the second pro-Palestinian mural to appear in Belfast in the last few weeks. Sheehan tells me many Irish feel a sense of solidarity with Palestinians because of their own history.
And particularly here in the north of Ireland, where we lived under the occupation of the British Army and 8 centuries, I suppose, of British occupation of Ireland.
But on the other side of the wall, it's a different story. That's the Shankill Road, a mainly Protestant neighbourhood. Most people living there describe themselves as unionists. They want Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom. And in the last 4 weeks, several Israeli flags have appeared in that area. Steve Aiken is the former leader of the Ulster Unionist Party.
If you look at the horrors of the 7th of October, the absolute sort of terror that was inflicted on innocent people, there was people in Ireland seemed to think that the Israelis themselves were responsible for that. And that actually hit quite closely with the psyche for many people in my community who went through 30-odd years of Republican IRA violence.
Aiken doesn't agree with the Irish Prime Minister's call for a humanitarian ceasefire. He says Leo Varadkar should keep quiet and let the real world powers deal with the issue. A couple of weeks ago, thousands of people marched through the centre of Belfast, waving Palestinian flags and chanting slogans. As they approached Belfast City Hall, they came face to face with a small group of people waving Israeli flags. Despite the angry exchange of words, Sinn Féin lawmaker Pat Sheehan says he doesn't think opposing views on the Israel-Hamas war will reignite sectarian violence in Northern Ireland. Sheehan says that one day Israelis and Palestinians might even learn something from the Northern Ireland peace process. Although right now, he says, that seems hard to imagine. For years, Sheehan didn't think talking to the other side would achieve anything.
We believed that there was no peaceful way to bring about political change. The only alternative for us was armed conflict.
Sheehan joined the youth wing of the IRA when he was 16, after loyalists came looking for him at his family home and opened fire. At 19, he was sent to prison, charged with causing an explosion in the centre of Belfast. 2 years after his release, he was back in jail again, this time for organising a bomb at a Belfast security checkpoint. But while Sheehan was doing time, politicians, paramilitaries, community groups and religious leaders from both sides had started to talk.
We realised that there was never going to be a military victory. The IRA were never going to defeat the British Army. British generals were saying, we are not going to defeat the IRA.
Gary Mason was a Methodist minister in Belfast at the time, and he spent a lot of time talking to loyalist paramilitaries.
And loyalist groupings realised they were not going to defeat the IRA either. So we realised the only way forward was a political solution.
Today, Mason runs an organisation called Rethinking Conflict, which works with people from divided communities. A lot of his recent work has been with Israelis and Palestinians. Mason says he gets asked all the time, how is it possible to sit at the same table with someone who's inflicted so much hurt on your community?
And I said, look, do you really think the first time we went into a room, we were popping bottles of champagne and hugging and kissing each other. People hated each other in the room. And I say to Israelis and Palestinians, you can't keep using this concept, we don't trust each other, as an excuse for not beginning dialogue.
Mason says he knows it will not be easy. In Northern Ireland, the Good Friday Agreement included terms that both sides found hard to swallow, including the release of political prisoners like Pat Sheehan. Today, Sheehan is an elected lawmaker in the Northern Ireland Assembly. Steve Aiken, the former Ulster Unionist Party leader, is a member of that assembly too. But this local government body hasn't actually been functioning for around a third of its existence because of political infighting. And Steve Aiken says he doesn't think Northern Irish politicians are in any position to tell people elsewhere how to sort out their problems.
I don't think we've got too many lessons to be able to preach. And I think actually we should sort ourselves out first before we decide to tell other people how they need to manage a peace process.
But Methodist Minister Gary Mason believes there are lessons to be learned from Northern Ireland. Courageous political leadership and the involvement of communities from all sides helped bring about peace. No group was excluded, he says. It's not perfect, Mason says, but we're a long way away from the violent days of the Troubles. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Tomorrow in San Francisco, President Joe Biden will meet Chinese leader Xi Jinping, an attempt to smooth out years of growing tension. Hanging over their encounter is China's increasingly aggressive military posture toward Taiwan. Taiwanese people, however, are not waiting to see whether the Biden-Xi meeting produces a flurry of mutual understanding. Polls show half of Taiwan's citizens are worried their army isn't doing enough to defend them from China. Yesterday, we reported on office workers prepping for a possible Chinese invasion. Today, The World's Patrick Wynn takes us to Taiwan's mountains to meet people trying to protect their homeland who are summoning their ties to Christianity.
It's Saturday morning. Worshippers are filing into a Presbyterian church made of stone, gathering inside its cavernous chapel, where a wooden cross towers above the pulpit. As the pews fill up, everyone begins to sing of love, a love bigger than the mountains and deeper than the sea. But when the singing stops, talk quickly turns to war. A man in his early 40s comes to the pulpit. He's got slicked back hair and determined eyes. He's wearing a woven vest, colored scarlet, with this black diamond pattern, like the scales of a viper. And behind him, there's a map of Taiwan. Boom, boom, boom. He's pointing out where Chinese missiles might strike first if war comes to the island. This is who I've come to meet, in the green hills of Pingtung County, southern Taiwan. A man who speaks like a mix between a military strategist and a prophet.
My name is Lavakao Tadimalao. You just call me Lavakao.
Unlike Lavakao, most people in Taiwan are ethnic Chinese. Many descended from mainland Chinese who fought against China's communist takeover in the 1940s. They lost that war and fled to Taiwan, 100 miles off China's coast. But Lavakao's people were already here. They're from the Paiwan ethnic group, one of the island's original peoples, with an ancient connection to the land. That pattern on Lavakao's vest evokes the scales of a pit viper. Many fear its poisonous fangs, but the Paiwan revere the snake. They say it can warn of approaching typhoons.
That kind of snake, they will... Then people will know danger is coming.
Today, Lavakao is gathering dozens of church leaders from around the area to forecast a different type of danger, one that is familiar to indigenous Taiwanese, who know all about invaders. Europeans showed up here nearly 500 years ago, converting most of them to Christianity. Waves of Chinese and Japanese colonizers have come since. But nothing, Lavakao says, compares to the modern threat posed by communist China, now encircling the island with fighter jets and warships on a near daily basis.
We risk Chinese invasion every day. We don't have much time.
When Lavakao speaks, people listen. He's the son of a Paiwan chief, his mother, and he's a political scientist with two PhDs studying civilian defense tactics. He recently started a network called Academia Formosana. Its mission is teaching indigenous Taiwanese, namely Christians, how to prepare for war. He says the stakes are existential. Just look at how communists treat minorities in China, he says, from Uyghurs to Tibetans to Christians.
Their churches are demolished and their pastors are put in jail. The Bibles are burned. So this is all very anti-Christ devil things.
Lavacao says those anti-Christ devil things are just one of many coming threats. What do you think the Taiwanese city folks are going to do when their cities get bombed?
And many of them already say, oh, we will run into the mountains because we can hide in the mountains.
The mountains, where many indigenous people live. Lavacao imagines mobs of starving people coming to steal food from indigenous communities. Or fellow Christians showing up, wounded, because their church just got blown up. Someone would have to treat their wounds. Lavacao has come here to tell indigenous church leaders, start planning now. Lavacao is asking them to fuse together more than 1,000 churches and more than 500,000 indigenous and ethnic Chinese Protestants into a rescue and defense operation, with indigenous believers running the show. He says, we know how to live off the land. We know how to endure occupation. But we need first aid training, secure communication equipment, and hidden stockpiles of supplies.
We are trying to save our own lives. Who can oppose you when you want to save your own life?
Perhaps Taiwan's army could oppose him. Most armies do not like civilians starting military-style operations that run parallel to their own. I spoke to a former high-ranking Taiwanese officer, Shen Mingshe. He's at the Institute of National Defense and Security Research, a government-funded think tank, and he advises Taiwan's military. I asked him to sum up what the top brass in Taiwan thinks about civilian-led defense squads.
Senior officer, I think you are not a general or military man. You don't know anything.
But Shen says, actually, army leaders have the wrong attitude. Lavacao is part of a growing trend in Taiwan. Civilian defense teams are starting up left and right. On the weekends, regular people will train for combat, with BB guns because real guns are restricted. Shen Mingshe says when groups like Lavacao's pop up, the army should help them because they can relieve the burden on the state in a time of war. Bring them onto army bases, he says. Teach them how to shoot real rifles.
If we can give them some training and equipment, they also can join the war and protect their city or protect their homeland.
When it comes to using guns, indigenous people in Taiwan already have an edge. They make up only 2-3% of the island's 23 million population, but only they have the right to own guns. But only primitive homemade muzzle loaders, like the kind used in the 1800s. They use them to hunt wild animals. Here's a man named Min Jie from the Bayuma indigenous group. Mountain boar, flying squirrel, monkeys, civets. That's what we hunt, he says. Min Jie grew up here in Taiwan's southern hills, but later joined the military's most elite unit, Airborne Special Ops. And since Min Jie is both an indigenous and a military man, I wanted his take on Lavacao's plan to build a Christian self-defense network. Min Jie says, look, our indigenous people do have that Sparta mindset. Sparta, I ask?
Sparta!
Sparta, okay. Sparta, like this is Sparta, the Spartan warrior society in ancient Greece. My co-reporter, Michael Garber, translates for Min Jie.
In our tribal tradition, every man is a warrior and has a responsibility to be able to fight like a soldier for the tribe if necessary.
Going back to the 1500s, every colonizer who's ever come to Taiwan has remarked on the fighting prowess of its aboriginal people. It's an established trope. So I wasn't sure if Lavacao would want to lean into that warrior imagery. But he said, we're proud of that reputation.
The Taiwanese originally are actually the last samurais on this island, the last warrior on this island. They can fight. They are good fighters.
Inside the stone church, hidden away in the hills, the Presbyterians are taking a singing break after all that talk of war. But soon they're back at it, diving into the details of forming an organized resistance. One pastor fears the city dwellers will abandon them if war comes. Another invokes Saint Michael, the warrior angel, who battles satanic forces in the Bible. All decide that, yes, they will sign up to Lavacao's plan. The Ark Plan, they call it, like Noah's Ark, a defense against a coming storm. From the pulpit, Lavacao leads them in prayer. It's Corinthians 12:12, a verse about the Christian flock. If one of us suffers, it says, all of us will suffer together. For the World, this is Patrick Nguyen in Taiwan.
Michael Garber contributed to that report. Ahead of the UN climate summit starting later this month, three big climate reports drop today. The news is not good in any of them. Let's just focus on today's report card from the UN itself. It analyzed the climate change plans of 195 countries and found that the world is still moving much too slowly to limit the effects of extreme heat, storms, and droughts. The UN found that even if countries fully implement their carbon-cutting plans, greenhouse gas emissions will still go up nearly 9% by 2030 compared to 2010 levels. Scientists say the world needs to cut those emissions 45% by then. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres commented on the report, "The world is failing to get a grip on the climate crisis." I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Last month, the United States reached a settlement in a class action lawsuit that could affect thousands of children and parents separated at the U.S.-Mexico border during the Trump administration. If the court approves the proposed settlement, it would help reunite families and provide them a pathway to asylum in the U.S. It would also enable many of those separated from family members to get mental health care. Kayla Young from public radio station WFAE in Charlotte reports.
The settlement establishes a few things. It'll limit family separations over the next 8 years to cases involving national security, the child's safety, medical emergencies, and certain criminal warrants. The settlement will also continue to reunite families who were separated under the Trump zero-tolerance policy that started in 2017. Kate Malloy Gettle, legal director at the American Immigration Council, explained that many people have been hard to track due to poor record keeping and speedy deportations.
Some of the families were in the United States with children at shelters in New York and Chicago, with parents stuck in detention centers on the Southwest border. But sadly, some were even already deported. Some of the parents were already deported and needed to be brought back into the country to be reunified. That process is still ongoing.
So far, the federal government has completed 3,126 reunifications. More than 1,000 children have not been confirmed as reunified with their families, however, and new cases continue to be identified through the Family Reunification Task Force. The MIS-L settlement will also provide access to benefits like a work permit, 3 years of behavioral health care, a year of medical and housing assistance, and immigration legal services for 6 years. The mental health care part is important, Gettle said, to treat resulting cases of post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and depression.
Being physically removed from a parent is going to create lifelong trauma and really interrupt the sort of attachment that is critical to parent and child. And so these families are going to be experiencing lifelong trauma, and the provision of mental health services and receiving mental health care is one way to try to work through that trauma.
Oscar and Glenda are asylum seekers who fled extortion and gang violence in Honduras. They now live in Charlotte. Both were separated from their children at the border in 2017. They're now represented by the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy, and they've already accessed benefits as plaintiffs in the MIS-L case, which has involved outreach to families for years now. Oscar arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border first with her then 8-year-old son. He wouldn't see him for more than a month.
Allá no me dijeron dónde lo iban a mandar, solo me lo quitaron.
They didn't tell me where they were going to send him. They just took him from me. After 15 days, they called me at an office. I went to speak with him, and that's when I learned that the boy was in New York.
Glenda arrived later with their other son, who was separated from her in the same ICE facility.
Ellos tratan de amenazarlo y decirle que le van a quitar los niños, que dice, ¿qué corazón tiene? Le dicen a uno, traerte este niño a que venga a sufrir. Pero es que ellos no saben.
They try to threaten you and tell you that they're going to take your children. They say you don't have a heart and that you brought the child to suffer. But they don't know why you came here. They say, you brought this child here to suffer and you aren't a good mother, you aren't a good father. They told me that for bringing my child here, they were going to donate him to a family that would treat him better.
Gettle says these stories were common among migrants who arrived to the U.S.-Mexico border from 2017 to 2018.
We heard many stories of both Border Patrol and ICE officers taunting the parents and talking about giving the children away or being deported without their children. And that was just so terrifying for some of these parents.
After they were reunited and connected with the Miss L case, Oscar, Glenda, and their sons were offered mental health services to help them overcome the effects of their separation. Glenda says she accepted the offer and so did the children. Connecting with a counselor helped her understand her night terrors and sleep more peacefully.
Sí, porque yo lo que sí me he quedado todavía es un gran dolor en la cabeza. Yo pienso que es lo mismo. A veces uno mira personas de repente.
What has stayed with me are the headaches. Sometimes I'll see a person and it makes my heart race, thinking it's them. My hands start to sweat. My therapist told me that when that happens, to try to remove it from my mind.
Oscar decided not to seek services, despite the pain he still carries.
I mean, it's always the same, the nightmares that stay with you. I haven't gone to a psychologist, but yeah, you end up damaged.
Their 14-year-old son has been in treatment, but he's still affected. Glenda says he wakes up screaming in the night, and he's terrified of law enforcement. More information about family reunification can be found on together.gov. Families separated between 2017 and January 2021 may qualify for services. For The World, this is Kayla Young in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Napoleon Bonaparte's hat is going up for auction this weekend outside of Paris. You know the one, black, kind of looks like a rounded off triangle with the points extending past the ears, and plain, except for a rosette of ribbon in red, white, and blue. Napoleon had 120 of these hats. He'd order 4 a year. Apparently, he hated the way they felt new, so he'd have his valets break them in for him. I guess being emperor has its perks. That hat became Napoleon's trademark, says auctioneer Jean-Pierre Osena. He spoke to AFP News.
Ce chapeau, il représente l'épopée napoléonienne. Il représente l'image de Napoléon dans le monde entier.
This hat, he says, represents Napoleon's image throughout the world. In the late 1700s, that style of hat, the bicorne, was common. Osena says it was part of the standard military uniform in Europe and in the U.S. But Osena says, unlike Napoleon's marshals, who put feathers and gold on their hats, Napoleon kept it simple, which was the point. He looked like a man of the people. Smart branding, considering France's monarch had just been sent to the guillotine. The way Napoleon wore the hat was unique, sideways, with the corners pointing left and right instead of front to back, like everyone else. It meant he was instantly identifiable on the battlefield. Only 20 or so of Napoleon's hats survive. The one going up for auction this weekend is expected to fetch more than $800,000. Good timing. Ridley Scott's biopic, Napoleon, comes out next week. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you all again tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now The World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much, and be well.